My 11th grade physics teacher had a sign on the wall. It said, "If at first you don't succeed, failure may be your thing." How true, how true. But today on Money Tree Podcast, we're going to be talking to an expert who says failure doesn't have to be your thing. In just a minute, I'll be bringing on Rick Newman, who wrote the book Rebounders, How Winners Pivot from Setback to Success. My name is Doug Goldstein. I am in the driver's seat today at Money Tree, so I get to do the interview and host our panel discussion with the phenomenal Money Tree Podcast panelists. So sit back, close your eyes, enjoy the show. Wait, well, don't close your eyes. Wouldn't want anyone falling asleep. No, that certainly won't happen on today's episode. Enjoy the interview.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Okay, we are talking with Rick Newman, who is a columnist for Yahoo Finance. He's based in New York. He's been covering business and economic trends, and he wrote a book called Rebounders, How Winners Pivot from Setback to Success. And Rick, that's what I want to talk about. Is it, you know, a lot of times people are kind of winners and some are losers, but when things don't go well for you, what do you need in order to rebound?
You need a lot of things. It starts with having some experience at failing at something. And, you know, one of the reasons I got interested in this was I cover a lot of business people as part of my job. And you hear all the time, oh, you know, what a great success this leader is or that leader is, took some startup and turned it into a $1 billion business. You don't often get the full story. And more often than not, when you ask these people, how did you get there? You find a lot of people who struggled at something, you know, something that really might have challenged them and made them think, you know, do I really want to be doing this? Took up all their time, caused them lots of questions about themselves. These sorts of crucible moments that people have had in business and in many other things. And then all you hear about is that they were successful. And, you know, the old saying is most overnight successes aren't. So that's why I got into this. And I got really interested in hearing the stories of people who had really struggled at something before they broke through. And I think this starts at an early age when we're kids. I think there's a sort of an art to learning how to fail at very small things that you might say are age appropriate. And then learning that when you fail at something or when it doesn't go your way, the world doesn't end. You find a way around it, often, in fact, almost all the time. You can put it back together, figure out what you did wrong, try again, and get it right the second or the third or the fourth time. So that's where it begins, I think.
Let's assume that this is a little more sophisticated than just, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And tell me a little bit more, maybe with one of the stories of someone that you spoke to or learned about. Why is it more than just what your grandmother told you?
It's not if you don't succeed as first, try again. In fact, a lot of people do that and they never succeed and they wonder why. And the reason is, if you keep doing the same thing, that doesn't necessarily raise your odds of success. I'm talking about people who try fairly difficult and complex things where success is nowhere near guaranteed. So you're talking about persistence, which is just stick at it. And that's part of it. But I, you know, one of the things I discovered is you need to know when to quit at something and try something else. Because if you're pursuing a bad idea, it doesn't matter how persistent you are, you're probably not going to succeed. And this is a real hallmark of what I call rebounders, is they are willing to self-assess and they're able to self-assess. And this is not, you know, this is not something you're just born, either you have it or you don't. This is a learned skill, the way math or learning how to play music is a learned skill. I mean, just about anybody can do it. But you have to be able to question, why did I do it the way I did it? Did I do it wrong? And if you're going to try again, try something different. So, you know, try to figure out why it didn't work the first time. This is a lot easier to say than to do, but people who have this ability to almost clinically analyze what was the reason that something didn't go right, those are the ones able to break through.
So let's focus on this one word which you brought up, which was quitting. And, you know, there are all sorts of great expressions about winners never quit and quitters never win. But it sounds like you're knocking all my expressions down one after the other. Would you say that one's not true either?
I think that is not true. I think winners do quit. Now, winners, you have to make some distinctions here. What is quitting, I guess? I don't want to get too semantic about it. But if you just give up without, you know, giving it your best effort, or if it's competitive and you just give up because you don't feel like seeing it through to the end, that is That is not a great attribute. That is lack of persistence, I would say. So I think it's a combination. The way to quit right, if you will, is a combination of persistence and analysis, understanding whether you are persisting at the right thing. And it's really important to say, you know what, if this is not the thing that I need to do, then I need to take everything I learned, maybe change my model a little bit, maybe change it a lot. And by the way, that's a way to sort of re-motivate yourself to, you know, give yourself a little bit of an emotional break, if you will. So you're not just, you know, rushing into the same stone wall over and over, but you're taking a different angle. You're trying something new. Maybe it's not a stone wall anymore. Maybe it's a different type of wall. Sorry for all these metaphors. But if what you're doing over and over is not working, try something else.
Try something new. Now, that makes a lot of sense, actually, in the world of investing, which is where I spend most of my time. In real life, not on the show, in real life, I'm an investment advisor, and I try to help people to make smart decisions. And the question always comes up, well, you know, I've got some stocks that are winners and some that are losers, or some funds that are better than others. Which ones should I sell? And interestingly, based on this quitting model, is that the academic studies seem to indicate that people who are need to raise some money are usually better off selling their losers, meaning they should quit. They should quit what's not working and holding on to their winners. It kind of sounds a little bit like what you're telling us here. Is that something you've seen also in the world of money?
I suppose. I mean, you're it's basically the question of cutting your losses, right? You know, when do you have to just say, this is, you know, I have to sort of just get out of this. And I think a big part of this is one of the attributes of rebounders I described is, you cannot get emotional about things that may actually be emotional to you. You have to find a way out of being emotional about them. I mean, you see this all the time in investing and also with people who start a business and feel so emotionally invested in that business that they can't give it up. But sometimes that thing that you're so emotionally invested in actually clouds your judgment. And this doesn't mean do not be emotional. Emotion is a very powerful, it can fuel success, but you have to be able to sort of step out of your emotion sometimes. And so you can, you know, more objectively analyze what's going on. And this, you know, this requires leaning on people that you trust, by the way. You know, one thing about investing is the obviously difficult thing about investing is the investing climate changes all the time. So gold may be a terrible investment today, but in 2 years, because the economy might change, it might be a great investment. So that's obviously another variable. But yeah, I think many of things do apply to investing. And I, you know, the way I'm thinking about a lot of this is how does it apply to careers and pursuing prosperity? But you know, investing's part of that too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. We're talking with Rick Newman, who is a real success. He's in many areas. You've probably seen him on CNN or Fox or MSNBC. He's written 4 books. We're actually not talking about his most recent one, but we're talking about the previous one called Rebounders, How Winners Pivot from Setback to Success. So let's dive more deeply into this question about investment failure. Because a lot of times someone fails once, twice, three times in investing, and over a career you may fail dozens of times. And you said before you have to not follow your emotions, but you know, let's be real, we're all people, and you fail enough times, you go, maybe this just isn't for me. How can you get yourself to stand up in the face of failure, like some of the successful rebounders that you studied?
Well, if you fail enough times at investing, you're not going to have any money left to invest, right?
So you're
going to be forced to try something new. Here's the way I think of it. Every time you fail, you need to learn something from that. And if you fail without learning, then that really is a failure. But if you fail and learn something from it, that is not a failure. That's arguably a meaningful experience, a growth opportunity. And it's those things you learn from failure. You don't get opportunities to learn those things in many other ways. I mean, you can take classes and listen to people tell you stories about how they failed. You can read about it in books. You can read what all the best investors tell you to do, but you never learn better than when it happens to you. And every failure, whether it's small or big, is an opportunity to figure out why did that failure happen? And the more you learn about why those failures happen, the more you are building a knowledge base, a database, you know, in some ways that's just experience and seasoning that is going to make you a lot smarter. You're going to be able to react faster. You're going to be able to anticipate what may go wrong better, and you will succeed.
That was a good pep talk. Are you also like a high school football coach to help people go, come on?
Not yet.
So what are some, are there specific things that someone can do in order to develop personal resilience?
I think there are. And there's been a lot of research into this recently. If you pay attention to the psychologists, a lot of times they talk about grit, G-R-I-T. This is sort of a new field of study that's become very popular. How do you develop grit? You know, I think, we've talked about some of these ways. I think first you have to challenge yourself. You have to be not afraid to fail. And one of the things I've just found personally is that the more you understand how many successful people have actually failed before becoming successful, it'll make you feel a little bit bolder about trying it. And, you know, so you can inform yourself somewhat. You know, a lot of people may grow up in a family or in an environment where failure is frowned upon and maybe there's not much tolerance of failure. But, you know, in the broader world, Silicon Valley, there's a lot of tolerance of failure in Silicon Valley. Now, what they say out there is fail fast. Don't do a slow motion fail that takes 10 years. If you're testing an idea and taking a chance, do it aggressively and do it as quickly as you can. And in Silicon Valley, quite often you're surrounded by investors who understand, you know, if VC, for example, maybe only one of 20 things they'll invest in will hit big. They understand the failures, but they also know when to get out of the failure. So that's the knowing when to quit model, because you've got resources there. If you're an investor, it's money. If you're an entrepreneur, it's your time and your effort and emotional capital to some extent, which is why it's really important to be as educated as you can and fail quickly. So those are some of the ways. I mean, I could sort of talk about this for a long time, but
I'll put it in a little bit more closely because I want to apply that. Certainly makes sense. But if you look at it from the outside, someone would say, well, obviously, if something's not working, get out. But the trick is to know, is it just not working or are you having a bad day? And a great example would be, you know, you look at a company like Apple Computer, which for years and years and years was doing nothing. And if someone was either working there or was investing in the company, he might have said, you know, forget, fail fast, let me just get out. But obviously, you know, in retrospect, and no one knows what's going to happen tomorrow, but retrospectively, that would have been a mistake. So in real life, normal people, how can they apply this fail fast principle to making real decisions about real money issues that arise?
Yeah, that's a good question. And in fact, I would add that in real life, failure is not always binary. It's not like either you succeed or you fail. Quite often, you're on the cusp of something. So you're not exactly failing, but you're not exactly succeeding. And that's actually very difficult to know. Let's say you're in a dead-end career. Do you just sort of accept it and ride it as far as you can go? Or do you take the risk of starting something new, which might mean you have to give up the old thing and accept the risk and some instability for a while? So I actually think in real life this is quite hard to figure out. And that's why I got deep in the weeds with people who've been through this. You know, sometimes what happens is they just hit a crucible moment where they almost just cannot go any further. You'll hear entrepreneurs saying, all my credit cards were maxed out. I was barely sleeping at night. I was having nightmares. I was borrowing money. I just knew this couldn't go on anymore. And other times you'll hear people say, well, I sort of set some goals and deadlines for myself. And if I had not met those goals or deadlines, that's the point at which I said, I don't think this is working. So most of this happens in a gray zone. This does not happen. This is not black and white. So I think those are some of the ideas. You have to know the toll it's taking on you. You have to think about opportunity cost. Can I be deploying my own personal resources, whether it's money you're investing, your own labor, whatever it might be? Can I get a better return on this someplace else? And how about, am I happy what I'm doing? And if this goes on for long enough, this is one of the hardest things, is getting yourself out of the gray zone and hitting that moment where you decisively do something.
You know, it sounds to me like what you're really saying is what I'll tell clients all the time when they ask me, you know, what's the best investment? I don't know what the best investment is. I really think it has to be customized for who you are. And also to touch on what you said, which is critical, is at the end of the day, you got to be happy with what you're doing. So whether it's in investing or managing or your career or you're on Silicon Valley and you're trying to fail fast, if you're miserable, then that's probably a very good indication that maybe you're not in the right spot. And a rebounder is someone who's going to say, you know, I don't want to be miserable. I'm going to go find something that makes me happy.
Yeah. Entrepreneurs love misery. They don't love it, but they are willing to go through it. In fact, at the closing chapter of my book, one of the 9 attributes of rebounders that I identified is they are comfortable with discomfort. You know, nothing comes easy, no pain, no gain. I mean, we all sort of know that if something that's worth attaining is worth working hard for and putting up with some discomfort. but you have to you have to set a limit and define these things for yourself. So how much discomfort is too much? That's a you can't answer that in any general way. It's a personal matter, but you have to know when too much discomfort, when enough discomfort is too much. And, you know, define for yourself what failure is. Define for yourself what success is. And by the way, I think we all sort of continuously redefine success as we move along. We probably have grandiose notions of success when we're young. Then we realize, boy, that's not so easy. We change our thinking a little bit. This happens, sort of happens continuously without us realizing it. You know what a lot of people do? They redefine success as they get more experienced and older, to focus more on quality of life and less on acquisitions or material wealth. So, you know what success is to you. And this is something you, I think successful rebounders are able to do this. Even if your definition of success changes later, what is it? What is success to you today? And what is failure to you today? Once you kind of know what those things are, these things are a little bit easier to comprehend.
All right, I think that is a great question to wrap it up. Rick, we are just about out of time, but in the last few seconds, tell us, how can people follow you and follow your work?
I have a website. It is Rick J. Newman. That's Rick J. NEWMAN.com. And I'm a writer for Yahoo Finance, as you mentioned, and my work is there all the time. So check out Yahoo Finance, finance.yahoo.com.
All right, we will put links to that at the show notes of today's show. Rick Newman, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Doug. Great conversation.
All right, we are sitting with the panel. We've got Miranda, Linda, and Joe. How are y'all doing today? Miranda, what's going on with you?
Hey, I am still in Idaho. I don't know how I've managed to do this for like 2 weeks in a row, but I think we've got a trend happening here.
All right, Miranda is living in her own private Idaho.
Right, exactly.
Joe, how are you doing this week?
Fantastic, now that I'm hanging out with you people.
It's awesome. And of course, we are hanging out with the wonderful Linda P. Jones. What's happening there, Linda?
Well, just trying to stay cool in the desert in, triple-digit temperatures, around 115 this week. Oh, yeah. Well, we have them, through the end of October, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. Well, thanks to global warming, Linda is nice and toasty. Linda, tell me, what do you think? Rick was talking about this idea of rebounders, and he spoke about comfort and discomfort, and you have got to be comfortable with discomfort. Frankly, it sounded like one of those inspirational speakers who tells you to do that. But, you know, the market often is uncomfortable. Do you need to be comfortable with it? I mean, do you think this is an emotion we all need to be developing?
You know, I thought that was a really interesting conversation. I have to say, I really enjoyed this interview. So kudos to you and to Rick.
Thanks.
It's interesting. When I first was getting into investing in individual stocks years ago, I remember thinking at one point, wow, I really am comfortable with being outside of my comfort zone. Like, that's where I actually could identify that's where I was living. And I'd say now it doesn't quite feel like that because I'm not so active like that. But it is more of a just, a comfort level, I'd say, yes. But there's also that sort of anything can happen. You never know if something's going to happen in China overnight and the market's going to drop 1,200 points. You never know if there's going to be another 1987. I mean, there's always the outlier event that I sort of always have in the back of my mind. But most days, it's pretty comfortable.
You're pretty cool with it. You know that there's the great Stephen Wright joke. He says, you know that feeling you get when you're leaning back in a chair and then it just about falls and you catch yourself? And I feel like that every day. So I like that joke. Joe, do you live that way? Do you live like in constant fear, or are you just like, hey, I'm cool, I'm in the stock market, I don't mind, 1987 or 1929 or...
I don't live in fear, but I think, Doug, that you have to kind of learn to be a contrarian, that when I want to high-five myself because my portfolio is going awesome, that's historically some of the times of greatest danger, right? When things have gone really well for a long period of time. And then when things are horrible and everybody around me feels horrible, that's the time of greatest opportunity. And so learning to be contrarian, as I was listening to Rick, I thought how I've trained myself over the years to have these opposite feelings where, like Linda, I'm comfortable with my strategy. I'm comfortable with what I'm doing, but I'm also reading the signals that the market's sending me different than I think most people do.
So Miranda, based on what Joe's saying, he's a signal reader. You know, there are times you feel comfortable, times you feel uncomfortable. And we all know, of course, when the market crashes, that's when you have to buy. And of course, when the market would go up, you'd want to sell. This year hasn't been so crummy. Are you saying, well, maybe we've reached the top? Or are you feeling that maybe we should hold on? Of course, you know, past performance is no guarantee of future returns.
Yeah, I think there's enough uncertainty happening right now, enough weirdness happening right now that, you know, there's the potential for some more turmoil. I think we're going to probably see some losses. But that doesn't make me uncomfortable. A lot in the market doesn't make me uncomfortable. I don't think about it. So most of the time, I'm well within my comfort zone with the market because I accept that there will be up and downs, and I'm fine with that. But yeah, so I definitely accept that there's going to probably be some more downs. And no, this year hasn't been crappy. I mean, it was funny because I was talking to somebody not too long ago and they're like, oh my gosh, the market is doing just terribly right now. And they were complaining about it. And I was like, wait, hold on. Let's step back a little bit. The market has struggled this particular week. But if you look at it, if you actually look at where it's at, and if you look at the Dow, you know, I was like, and at the time the Dow was just barely, it was over 18,000. It was dropping back down again toward 18,000. And I was like, wait a minute, the Dow is above 18,000. It's much higher than it was last year. What do you mean it's crappy? It's down this week as compared to last week.
People are very fickle, don't you feel?
What are you talking about, crappy? I'm like, it's crappy from the standpoint that it's probably overheated right now, and we're probably due for a nice big flash crash or even a bigger crash. But from the standpoint of, oh my gosh, you know, it's just doing so bad this week, I'm like, no, it's not. It's way up on the year. It's way up as compared, and I'm like, and if you really want to get crazy, compare it to what it was 3 or 4 years ago. Come on now.
Well, and that's what drives me crazy, Miranda, is that, you know, people, I'm tired of the phrase, well, the market's at all-time high, so it's got to go backwards. Well, the market goes up about 70% of the time, so the market should be at all-time highs a fair amount of the time. The market's going to be at all-time highs, and that doesn't mean that the market's coming down. But still, I agree with Miranda that there seems to be a lot of uncertainty right now. I mean, around everything from the U.S. election to the Federal Reserve to profits next quarter. So there's a lot that feels like it's blowing in the wind right now.
You know, there are some signs of things that are not looking good. And one of the things is that a lot of companies have not met their earnings. And so earnings are really declining for the average company. But, you know, the market is heavily weighted toward a few stocks. And so those stocks lift the whole, you know, the whole tide. And so, you know, what we're seeing is some unhealthiness under the market with earnings. And then we also see this very strange pattern with the VIX, which Miranda and I have talked about in the past that we watch. And the fact that the VIX has been incredibly unvolatile. It's been incredibly steady, which, you know, who knows what's really going on there. But that is not normal. It portends that maybe there's something around the corner that may happen that may bring that back to where it usually is. So just a couple of interesting things.
The VIX, because it's actually been kind of a weird thing for me too, because I've been looking at it. Because back with the Brexit vote, I was trying to decide whether or not I wanted to pull the trigger. I do have some VIX, and I was thinking of selling it because it was rising so fast. But then when I looked at the 52-week, when I looked at the 52-week numbers, and I looked at how it seemed to be steadier than it should have been, considering all of the turmoil, I was like, you know, I think I'll sit on it for a little bit longer. So I'm still waiting. I'm still waiting to unload my VIX. But yeah, I found that too. I found that a little bit odd that, considering everything with the presidential election, everything with what's been going on over the summer, everything with the Federal Reserve, even if you look at like the potential housing bubble in Canada, just the things happening around the world, I would think that the VIX would be doing a little bit more than it is.
Right. Mm-hmm. This is how weird the VIX weirdness has been that Linda Miranda been talking about, is that the VIX never makes the popular press. Never, ever. And John Wagoner, who writes for USA Today, wrote about the VIX just about a week and a half ago. And it's so surprising that I'm reading about the VIX in USA Today, which is, you know, like listening to it, reading it on the cartoon network. That's very strange.
I'm not sure that you say why it's not in the main media, because it's here on Money Tree Podcast. We talk about it just about every week. Miranda, take a minute just to go to some of the basics. Tell people what the VIX is and why you invest in it.
Well, so the VIX, well, why I invest in it was because I just did it for fun because it was silly. But no, the VIX is sort of this measure of market volatility. So it's one of those derivatives that we all hear about, and it basically measures how volatile the market is. For lack of a better word, invest in the expectation of market volatility. So it works kind of interestingly well as a hedge when people are like, oh, well, you know, we're going to diversify with stocks and bonds. We're going to hedge with maybe a little gold or something. The VIX actually works really well as a hedge during times of uncertainty and times when the stock market is just having a serious problems. And so it's a nice thing to have as a hedge, I think, if you can stomach it. A lot of people look at it and they're like, I don't know about that. It's a little weird. But I actually ended up getting into it a couple years ago during an investing challenge. And just to add one of those fun things to try it out to see how it went. And then I've never really unloaded it. And every now and again, I remember that I have some and I look at it and I try and decide, is now the time to pull the trigger?
So would you recommend it as a position that someone just puts in his portfolio and keeps there, or it's really a trading kind of thing?
Ooh, I think it depends on what you're planning to do with it. I personally, obviously, am using it as something that just sits there because I'm just waiting for, I don't know, the opportune moment. But yeah, no, it's one of those things that works reasonably well as a long-term hedge if you're really concerned about the stock market and you're not overly concerned about having hard assets as your hedge, if that makes sense. A lot of people prefer harder assets like real estate or gold or something like that as their hedge against a falling dollar or against a falling stock market. But if you don't care if you have hard assets, then the VIX can be kind of an interesting hedge.
All right. Well,
does anybody disagree with that? Speak up now.
Anyone disagree? Here you go, because you got to lock it in now. Otherwise, we're moving on. Ding, ding, ding. Everyone agrees. Nice. I think that the VIX is a tool that people should use really more for trading, because if you just tuck it into your portfolio as a long-term piece, it doesn't make sense. It's not a long-term growth kind of investment. It's a position you're taking on volatility. People who are long-term growth-oriented are going to buy stocks. They'll look for value one way or the other, whether you are, you know, an earnings lover like Linda, or you just use a crystal ball like Joe.
I see what you did there.
Hey, Linda, tell me something. Our guest, Rick Newman, said that people should try to fail fast in Silicon Valley when they're starting, you know, with startups. And if something is just flopping, just get out. You know, it's okay to fail, but just do it quickly. The problem is when someone's an investor in the stock market, sometimes, you know, even good companies don't do well for a while. They look like they're failing. Do you think the fail fast philosophy applies here?
I do, actually. I am a believer that you sell your losers and let your winners run, which you brought up with him. I think that in my experience, that has worked very well for me. The companies that are going down tend to continue to go down, and you never know where the bottom's going to be or how much further they can go, even though they may have already dropped a lot. So it's hard to find a bottom. They in Wall Street, they say hard to catch a falling knife. And I think you want to get those companies that are increasing in earnings, that have good charts, that are going up in value, and that may be catching a little momentum. I'm okay with that, but I really think that you want to sell your losers and keep those winners.
So, Joe, are you more patient than Linda, who Doesn't want to catch a knife?
No, what I really like, though, that that Rick said is that it doesn't have to be binary. And I love that, because I think that a lot of the time we just want to be in all winners all the time. And I'm very interested in system and process, and what's the system we're using, and then what's the process we're using to make decisions. And that's part of what I loved about this interview, is that instead of just selling off a stock, look at what were the reasons that you bought that position. Are there things that you can improve in the process that make sure that that doesn't happen again? Or is it just a stock that went the wrong way? And I think that if you're constantly refining your process and you're looking at that instead of just looking at the, you know, looking at the root of the tree instead of the leaves, I think you're going to do a much better job at failing forward.
I love that tree metaphor here on the Money Tree podcast. The question's like this, not that I want to send everyone away who's listening to us today, but you're saying you want to develop a system and a process. There are plenty of people out there who have been working on developing systems and processes for a long time. We can see what they've done. They run mutual funds. They run hedge funds. They're money managers. Why should all of, you know, the four of us, and as well as the, you know, what is it, 4 or 5 million listeners a month that we have, why should they be trying to reinvent the wheel instead go with the system and process that works?
No, it doesn't even have to be that, Doug. Let's say that we're using your approach and we're hiring managers. And for some reason, we hire a manager that ends up being the wrong manager. Well, then I still have a system and a process of how I hired that manager. I just don't throw a dart and say, I'm giving Miranda all my money because she's going to put it in the VIX. I don't.
You should totally give me all the money.
I don't do that. I should have a system and a process of hiring that person. So even if I'm not interested in stock picking, I have to be interested in what is the process I use to create my investment mix.
All right. And Miranda, other than buying the VIX, do you have a specific process in choosing the our ETF Pro? Do you have a specific process, or is it just, you know, the feel?
I am the worst, right? So no, I have to.
No, you're not. That's why we're turning to you.
Right. So I'm an indexer. And so for the most part, most of what I do is, for the most part, for my long-term retirement investing, I chose some all-market funds, some high-yield bond funds, and some TIPS, and then an all-world fund. And I did that. And I did that years ago, and every month I dollar cost average into those items. I mean, and that's what I did. That's my long term.
That's the system and process that Joe's talking about. Okay.
Yeah, that is most of my investing. Now, occasionally, if I'm part of an investing challenge or I think something looks fun, I will take play money. I will take money I don't need, and I will do something like, hey, I'm interested in the VIX. I want to try it out. Hey, I'm interested in this gold ETF. I want to try it out. I'm interested in building, I'm trying it. I interviewed Andrew Hallam, and he's really into this thing called the permanent portfolio. And actually, I think we talked about him in a past episode here on the Money Tree Investing podcast. So Andrew Hallam and the permanent portfolio. I wanted to try that. And so I took some of my play money and I tried that. I divvied it up and I tried this permanent portfolio and tried that mix. And then when I'm choosing, when I want to boost my income portfolio, I've got my travel fund and I've got my emergency fund, and those are more like a spider ETF, just a S&P 500 ETF. And then the other one is a dividend one where it pays dividends. And I just chose a fund that follows the dividend aristocrats. And then I have a REIT. So basically that's it. It's just me looking at things.
Oh, no, that's great that you can actually say exactly. I asked you what your process and your system is, and you were able to say it exactly, which I think is very impressive because so many people can't do that. So
Yeah. Basically, I figure out what I want to dollar cost average for different goals, and then I pick some things that are going to meet those goals. Like for my travel fund, it's income. I want income, so it's all stuff that pays dividends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that
it's all funds.
No, it's all designed for a certain idea. And yes, I'm a big fan of funds. Let's focus on failure a little bit more. And Linda, I'm turning to you about failure.
Thanks, Doug.
Because when I think of failure, I think of you having something to teach us. No, because you've been a great success. And one of the problems when people look at people who are successes is they go, she just has the magic touch, right? She knows what she's doing. But do you mind sharing with us maybe a failure you've had in your investing world and what you learned from it so you did something differently after that?
Oh, my gosh. I've had tons of failures. I mean, I think you can't be an investor and not fail. It's just not realistic. And if anyone tells you that they've never made a bad investment or a bad choice, then they're not being honest, I think. So, yeah, I mean, definitely bad investment choices, of course. I often tell the story, the very first investment I made was down 30%. I mean, it's not uncommon to have something happen that it goes the wrong way. But
what did you learn from that?
I think what you learn is that you can recover from it, that it's not... unless you quit and you throw in the towel, you can recover and you can buy investments that will do well. You can get better as an investor. You can learn to be a better investor and you can have a process that will, take that to the next level. But I also want to just comment on the concept of failure because one of my favorite people to model for business is Sarah Blakely, who is the founder of Spanx. And she is a self-made billionaire who owns 100% of her company. She never had to sell out any of her company to a venture capitalist or raise funds or money. And the reason that I'm such an admirer of hers is because her whole concept around failure is that it doesn't really exist. That it's really just a matter of if something isn't working, you got a specific result. And then you move to the next result. And from that sort of thinking, she was able to, create $1 billion for herself. And I think she's in her 40s. So, Wow. Yeah, pretty outstanding. And I think, it goes back to that's the way her dad taught her to think. And that there was really no failure. It was just, you tried one thing that didn't work. You try something else. And just not to really revel in that word failure. I just think, if we can sort of reframe it out of our vocabulary, I think that's a good thing.
Well, it's only $1 billion, you said, but not bad. So, Joe, people don't think of stacking Benjamins and failure in the same sentence because, frankly, you listen to the show and it's a financial guy and he's having a lot of fun. And obviously, you've got a lot of experience. But again, you don't feel like there's a lot of failure going on in the Joe Saul Sehy universe. But I'm guessing there is. Is there some, like, let's play a little truth or dare. And only truth is your option, no dare. I don't really want to dare you to do anything. Could you give us something that that you've done wrong that maybe we could all learn from?
Well, how about this one? Here's a good one. So in the early days of satellite radio, and I love new technology. I always get excited when I see new things. In fact, I listen to a bunch of podcasts about new technologies coming out all the time and not really to invest in them just because it's what I like. But also, the basis for what you invest in, partly a little bit, should be what you like because you're going to follow it consistently. So I had heard of this new cool thing, satellite radio, and I thought that it was going to be awesome. So I bought shares of XM Radio for just over $4 a share, and it went up over 30. And then I sold it. And when I sold it, and here's the mistake, I bought Sirius Satellite Radio. So I bought their competitor, which is dumb. Why do you sell one company and buy another company in the same exact space? Because, most of the time the companies are going to move together. But I didn't know that. And I was still high in the technology. So I decided to buy both of them. Of course, everybody, well, you may not know the story from there, but the companies merged. They almost completely went under. The stock at one point went down around $2 a share. And it has kind of hummed along and done pretty much nothing. So I made a ton of money. And then I diversified, which wasn't diversification at all. And I lost all the money that I made. And now I own a bunch of stock that's the same company plus the competitor all wrapped into one.
And what's the takeaway that everyone should write down on their Money Tree podcast notebook?
When you sell, remember what diversification really is.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we have to diversify on a number of things, including the discussion today, because we are just about out of time. But I want to leave a last minute for not to talk about failure so much. And by the way, the reason I'm skipping myself is on this question is because I've never failed.
I'm sorry. Did I laugh? I didn't mean to laugh. Was that impolite?
I think I've told you this story, though, and I just got out of stockbroker school, and I thought I was pretty smart because I was good at math. I started trading options, and I did very well for a week, and then I lost it all, and then a lot more. And my mother, who was my partner at the time, just started laughing at me, and I was pretty upset. And she said, it's good you lost it now, because now you don't have much to lose. And that was a great lesson, too, which just don't think you're smarter than everyone else. But as we are wrapping up, Miranda, could you tell us what is going on in your world?
Oh, man. So, yeah. So what's going on in my world is I'm still trying to get myself together. But if you go to MirandaMarquette.com, you can actually find 5 financial mistakes that many freelancers make when they first get started. And so this is something that a lot of people have asked me about, is what are some of those financial mistakes you make when you first get started as a freelancer? But it also kind of translates to other business type things. So if you're just getting started with a business, or if you're trying to figure out how you want to move forward and kind of work for yourself, head on over to MirandaMarquette.com and take a look at some of those mistakes that freelancers make when they first get started.
All right, awesome. Hey, and how about you, Linda? What's new in your world?
What's new in my world is on the Be Wealthy and Smart podcast, we're talking about the most and least expensive cars to maintain.
Oh, okay. I don't even know what to say. I love the idea. Okay, I'm just thinking
like
of
that's like a new kind of a thing for Linda. Like,
well, you know, sometimes I go through. I mean, we'll talk about investing. We'll also talk about business, and we also talk about ways to save money. I mean, we have a whole bunch of things that we talk about. But I thought this was particularly interesting because I've often said that over the lifetime, your lifetime, I think you can save about $250,000 by not buying cars too frequently.
Wow. Wow. That's a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, do you have a spare $250,000 to buy cars?
I do. I'll just write a check from
Miranda Marquette.
Right, from Miranda's account, and we'll be good.
What's going on in Stack and Benjamin's world?
In the Stack and Benjamin's world, from the basement, we've had we got a couple cool things coming up. You know, they say you have to spend money to make money. Well, Lauren Groopman spent a lot of money that she didn't have to try to become rich and famous, and ended up getting herself into huge amounts of debt. So she tells that story. She kind of, you know, the analogy, I guess, Doug, is she touched the stove so that you don't have to, right? All you got to do is listen to Stack and Benjamin's, and you'll get her story.
And you get the stove. All right. Well, I think I mentioned last time, but we've put out this toolkit for people living outside the United States who want to have U.S. brokerage accounts. It's filled with information, and secretly, we're actually able to see which bits of information people are most interested in. And one of the most interesting things is people just want to know why it's good to invest through U.S. brokerage accounts. So anyone who wants that can go to my corporate website at profile-financial.com/toolkit. I think that wraps it up for me for the day. Miranda, can you take us out?
Head on over to MoneyTreePodcast.com to check out the latest episodes. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher and send us your questions. We love to read the mail we get from you, and we love to answer your questions in the best way we know how, which is sometimes inadequate. But go ahead, check us out, and remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.